Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we've just kind of wrapped up a lot of conventions around the nation. And when I mean conventions, we're talking about the Republican Party, state-level conventions. And it's kind of ironic, folks, whether you know it or not, in the state now, Georgia didn't have a state yet. They had district conventions. Their state convention is still coming. But many of the states, I mean, the campaign for the presidential election is just heating up. I mean, it is just rhetoric and so forth as they're still whittling down their candidates at the party level. But just so you know, the electors have already been chosen. The electors, the electoral college, which is to be chosen by you, the people, is being chosen as we, you know, go through this year. The party is meeting in these closed conventions, choosing the electors for you. Now, there's nothing, there is nothing within the Constitution that actually allows that to happen. Nothing at all. It has been presumed and assumed by the federal government in basically allowing the state, or actually allowing the parties, to control the politics in the states and in America. So I want you to really think about this concept of a representative government. A representative government is representative of you, the people. Now, you were born into, you know, your race. You're born into, you know, your sex. You're born into very specific, let's call them demographics. Did you know that we're born into a party system? And even though you aren't, you know, genetically created to become one part of this party or a part of that party, you either adjoin to a party because that's how we govern ourselves now, or you're going to be in the out, you know, I'll just say you're the flotsam and jetsam that is, you know, just tossed around, you know, coming in with the tide and then going out with the tide. You're just debris. Folks, the only thing that is going to heal this country is that people start understanding the simplicity of a Republican form of government, that the parties don't have any control, and that the most important government, the most important representation you actually possess is that government you have really failed to form. It was formed for you. And as a matter of fact, when we go through this, I'm actually in Madison's notes today, I'm going to focus on new states' admission into the union. We've kind of covered some of this stuff before. But the reason this is so important is because of this concept called federal lands. Now, there are, I'll just say, and I kind of talk about this in my mentoring meetings and so forth, or I should say, the groups that I work for and I support. And so we go into this paradigm of federal lands. And whether you know it or not, the federal government has come up with what they call their interpretation of federal lands. And there's nothing in the Constitution, by the way, that actually is quote unquote federal lands. In the Constitution, they've enumerated powers. And I want to make sure you understand that the only powers, quote unquote powers, that were delegated to the federal government are clearly identified. And actually, this was stipulated in the ratification debates. The powers delegated were right there listed in Article 1, Section 8. nowhere else. So if it's in a different article and somebody says, well, that's a power, no, you got to back out, look at it and go, hold on here. What is this really a power, or is this a role or a responsibility? Because that is probably more what it is. Now, there were specific properties enumerated that the federal government or this general government would have the authority. Now, here's the caveat: the authority to purchase. In other words, the Constitution allows them to possess these types of lands and only those types of lands. Why? Because the framers understood that property was the true value. In other words, if you control the land, you control everything. I mean, isn't that a fundamental military principle? Once you, you know, have a forest beachhead, you go in and you create, you know, your enforcements, and you advance and advance and advance, and all the land you take, you now control. And it's yours. That's how it is. And so, kind of interesting, though, that is a traditional paradigm. When we look at how the European nations were operating under the, you know, conquests, under the laws of nations, which was what was the governing document for all of these nations of Europe. In other words, they weren't all just singing and whistling Dixie or whatever to their own tune. They were all abiding by this agreed upon law that was called the Laws of Nations. And all of these European nations, these conquesting nations, Portugal, Spain, France, the United Kingdom or Britain, Holland, all of them, agreed, they kind of met and created. It's kind of like this UN charter that is unconstitutional, has no authority. But in those days, the crowns actually kind of all seceded that they were going to abide by these rules. Now, when you look at how they did conquest, it wasn't like, you know, they went and tried to control and police every square inch of the land. Now, they did that to their area, but it was unreasonable. There's a good word for it. It was unreasonable for the king to exert so many resources, whichever king, Spain or what have you, to exert so many resources to controlling such a mass or vast area. Now, when you look at how Spain and Portugal inflicted pain upon the inhabitants, the indigenous people, then you can actually see how it wasn't their design. In at least it wasn't Spain's necessarily their design to occupy and control. What they did was they came in and seized all goods. They used force, brute force. And then what they did to basically create this harmony with them and the inhabitants, they basically impregnated all these, you know, massive amounts of women with their own children, so that they created a mulatto race. And in so doing, they basically kind of annihilated. It was almost a form of genocide or a form of, you know, creating a new race so that the occupants of that land were beholden to them and had these ties, affections, whatever they, you know, whatever the purpose was. That's exactly what they did. I mean, that's what created the Mexican, you know, the race. There are Spaniards, there's Mexicans, and there's Indians, right? And I'm not an anthropologist or anybody that could, you know, teach classes on this, but this is just fundamental stuff. That was not within the laws of nations. In other words, I'm telling you, what Spain and Portugal were doing were actually violations against the laws of nations. Now, what Britain was doing and what France was doing, they were trying to be, and Holland, the northern European nations, they were doing everything they could to try to abide as much as they could by these principles. And so that's why they, you know, the British Crown specifically started creating these treaties with Indians. Now, when we conquered and took that land, we created the ability to have treaties, but we didn't have the ability to grant them land or to, you know, to give them that type of basically an affirmation that this is yours. And so Thomas Jefferson pointed this out. This is why this is so important, understanding these little nuances of what's in that Constitution. Thomas Jefferson told Congress, we need an amendment to allow us to actually grant and provide land, our own land, to the Indians. They didn't want to do that. So with the Louisiana Territory, he penned an amendment and gave it to Congress, and Congress just ignored it, saying, we don't have that power. We don't care to have that power. And then down the road, 20, 30 years later, with Andrew Jackson, who started creating these hard territories in the West and so forth, and they were violating the Constitution in doing that. Now, unraveling all of this stuff is going to be hard to do. And, you know, fixing the harm inflicted is impossible to do, because what we can do is we can move forward. We can get things right and move forward and allow people to possess their land. But to be clear, every state that had been formed in the Union is sovereign over that land. Now, you may have religious groups, you may have, you know, like the Amish and so forth. They created their own little settlements and they have their own little areas, but they're not sovereign in that state. There's no Amish state within a state. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that has kind of occurred since the late last century, the 20th century, is rich Mohammedans have come and purchased large plots of land and have tried to create their own sovereign nation where they actually inflict Sharia law. Now, to be clear, no state like that can form within a sovereign state. The Constitution doesn't allow that. And as a matter of fact, the 14th Amendment constrains any state from allowing or creating any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. In other words, they cannot make or enforce any law. And if there is a law within any state that abridges your privileges and immunities, such as a no-go zone or these protected little Islamic compounds or what have you, I'm sorry, folks. You have a right to be able to utilize, you know, your rights, I guess your inalienable rights, no matter where you go. Doggone it, you want bacon, you want to be able to sell bacon or buy bacon. Now, you can't force people to buy it from you, and you can't force people to, you know, sell it to you, but you have that right. They can't make a law to, you know, inflict upon you that you can't sell it or you can't buy it. So when we really start peeling all of this back, we start realizing that it's one thing to have the freedom of religion, and it's another thing to have, you know, the ability to create a nation. In other words, when we start looking at, you know, is this an ideology, is this a culture, or is this, a society, a governing society? Anyway, I'm sorry for going down this rat hole, but these are conversations that I have all the time, and we need to expound upon that. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to go through this. It's called the CRS report, and I think it's the Congressional something-something, resources and science, whatever. And the name of this, and this was December 3rd, 2007, shortly after the Patriot Act. Federal Land Ownership, this is their title, Federal Land Ownership, Constitutional Authority and the History of Acquisition, Disposal, and Retention. In other words, they've assumed this unbridled power over any and all land that they think they want. In other words, they have completely obviated the limited and defined property that the states have allowed them. And we, the states, have completely forgotten that they don't have these authorities. This is all tyrannical. And anyway, so as you go through this, and this is, you know, these are attorneys that have created this. And what I want to do is get down to the this kind of a conclusion area. And it starts on page, what is this? Page 4. And this federal land ownership, constitutional authority, and the history of acquisition, disposal, and retention. And so when we get down to the constitutional basis, this is actually on page 5. Constitutional basis for federal land ownership. That's the subtitle. The property clause. Now, this is what they call the property clause. The U.S. Constitution addresses the relationship of federal government to lands. The property clause, Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, gives Congress authority over the lands, authorities, and other property of the United States. It reads, Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. Now, I wanted to read that as the precursors so that when we go through the framers in the Constitutional Convention discussing the land of new states and who owned what and how these new states, because the whole point of Article 3 or Article 4, Section 3 is the admission of new states into the Union. And this is not the second clause, by the way. This is the fourth clause of that responsibility delegated to the federal government. And they've been granted this subsidiary power in lieu of that responsibility in admitting new states into the Union. And so here they go when they can take this, you know, it's just like how churches would go in and take one little word or not a word, but a small little statement, a phrase out of the scriptures and say, you know, by this, and they would take this whole sermon and basically completely redefine what that phrase really meant, taking it completely out of context. And that's the magical power of, you know, government, when they can do such great magical things with such hard, tangible objects. How do they, you know, and it's just like with wood. You can bend wood. It takes time, and it takes water and so forth to get it to stretch, bend, and so forth, and get it into the, you know, the curl or whatever it is you're looking to do. But you can do it. But that doesn't mean that that's the legitimate form of it. It's a perverted form, and it may suit your needs, but in government, the Constitution is a very rigid thing. You just can't add water and soften it and twist it. But lawyers can, if we let them. And if we let them, they'll completely take every defined clause as it was defined and completely pervert it. So this is why this is so important. If there's anything that we're going to provide you this year are some, I'll just say, deep fundamental understandings on the limitations of this general government that was created to serve the states. In other words, I mean, in some respects, I refer to government as a hierarchy of a family. That we, the people, are the absolute parents of all government. And the government that we create is our county government. So in a way, we refer to that as our child government. The next government created is not by we, the people. It's created by delegates from our county government that, you know, is selected out of we the people, that go from all of the counties in an area, we call it a territory, or it's what's to become a state, And those people actually form and create the constitution and government for that state. It's not done by, you know, the body whole or by, it's a small select group of representation of each of the counties. And that's the same way counties are created. It's created by a representation of all of the different parts of the county. No area is to have any greater influence just because it has more people. As a matter of fact, we're going to get into how and why this is so important, that it's not about, just persons, which is, if you really look at one of the most important and one of the greatest lessons we learn in this whole system, is the balances and the checks and balances of ensuring we are never to be subject to mob rule or tyranny of the few. There are these checks and balances, which is why in the Senate, representation is equal amongst the state legislatures. That is, the suffrage of the state legislature is represented by two senators, and each state has equality in their suffrage. When it comes to the representation of the people, that's different. It's based on how many people are being represented in that. And what's really important, and we're going to get into this because Madison talks about why it's not really about equality. It is about representation of the interests of the vicinity, of the community. It's still based on numbers, but one of the things that was destroyed by this Patrick Henry gerrymandering, the way parties started dividing us, is to actually start creating advantages for themselves and taking away the representation of the community. So anyway, let me move forward with the notes on the Constitutional Convention. I have basically less than 2 minutes left. And so what I want to do, and this is kind of stuff we've already covered, and if I remember correctly, let me pull this up. I want to see where we are with regard to the date, and this is on July 5th, and this is regarding new states being formed in the Union, and parts of these we've already read, but there's expounding parts that I've added to this. So anyway, it starts off with Mr. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, who objected to that scale of apportionment. He thought property ought to be taken into the estimate as well as the number of inhabitants. Life and liberty were generally said to be more of value than property. An accurate view of the matter would nevertheless prove that property was the most main object of society. The savage state was more favorable to liberty than the civilized, significantly so to life. It was preferred by all men who had not acquired a taste for property. It was only renounced for the sake of property, which could only be secured by the restraints of regular government. Now, I'm going to stop right there because when we come back, I got less than 30 seconds. So when we come back, I'm going to pick this back up. You got to remember that the southern states, they knew they had all the money. The southern states knew that they had the high value, and we kind of have already covered this, that the southern states, since they were going to be paying the taxes, they were expecting the rest of the states to provide the protection. In other words, those people in the militia, those people that would actually go and protect them in the Union, and since they're paying for it, they expect that service. In other words, they were not going to be able to really pay the full load, or at least that's their view. And so we're going to kind of shake this through as to how the differences of property were being viewed. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, keep in mind as I move forward that these men from these different areas, Pennsylvania, the Carolinas, and so forth, they had very different views. Their paradigms were not the same. Okay, so anyway, back to what I was saying here. These ideas, this is again Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, he says, these ideas might appear to some new, but they were nevertheless just. If property then was the main object of government, certainly it ought to be one measure of the influence due to those who were to be affected by the government. He looked forward also to that range of new states which would soon be formed in the West. He thought the rule of representation ought to be so fixed as to secure the Atlantic states a prevalence in the national councils. In other words, here was Mr. Governor Morris actually laying out this idea that the eastern states should have superiority over the western states. This was his paradigm now. The new states will know less of the public interest than these will have an interest in many respects different. In particular, will be little scrupulous of the involving the community in wars, the burdens and operations of which would fall chiefly on the maritime states. In other words, he's basically saying that, you know, okay, so let's stop right here. Let's look at the world at their time. Did they see the great hordes that put the fear of God in these men? Where were those hordes? They were away across big bodies of water. Now, they didn't have the ability to just whip up a bridge and just cross this bridge with Genghis Khan type of forces. In other words, the sad part of Europe and Asia, the Eurasia, that you know, somehow two continents in one. I mean, have you ever thought about that? How is Eurasia actually two continents? I mean, is there some river that divides them? No. It's literally one landmass. And so when Genghis Khan, you know, went through and decimated Asia or Eurasia, he was able to do so because the ability to pick up your forces, put them on horses and wagons and so forth, and actually project your force. America was in a completely different situation. To project force, you had to have a lot of ships. And as a matter of fact, those ships could only, you know, occupy. They didn't have these cruise ships that take, you know, tens of thousands of people. You have to understand that you were, I mean, look at how many people were able to pack into the Mayflower. It was the people that were coming to America was less than 200. So how many of those ships would you need to really bring a formidable army to actually take on the millions of people in America at that point in time? It would have taken a lot. And I'm telling you, it's not something that would have just, you know, hey, you wake up and, wow, where'd all these people come from? We've got an army among us. It took time. As a matter of fact, the only reason Britain had an advantage in the war is because it wasn't a Cold War. It was truly a revolution. A revolution of the people of Britain in America that revolted against their own government, casting them off. So they had already had forces here, and they actually already saw and recognized the turmoil amongst the inhabitants. You know, the natives were growing restless. So they were already shipping people. So the logistics involved in trying to project that type of force, you have to understand, and this is why we're going to go through this, so that you understand the extent and the reason why the militia, no standing army was to be formed and to be limited by 2 years of funding period, and that the Navy was the primary defense because they knew that the majority of their threat was going to come from the water beyond. Now, there was a possibility that Britain and, you know, or other nations could have started building a civilized military, I should say, not even a civilized, a military force in the Pacific Northwest or in, you know, the central part of the, you know, or the Western United States, which would be, you know, kind of like the, I guess, the Eureka area down to San Francisco, where, you know, it's not as mountainous and thick forest and all of that. But nevertheless, my point is that in the late 1700s, Britain and or another European nation or a couple of European nations could have, you know, joined together to actually begin to create a force to oppose the United States from making it all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Why didn't they do it? I'm telling you, they wanted to. They wanted to, but they didn't have the resources to do it because they were battling themselves. They were always fighting all of these wars, and they still did not have a collective peace. They couldn't actually put their guards down because they were at odds with each other. This is why they created the laws of nations, so that they would all kind of agree to be good with each other, or to, you know, kind of be civil. But I mean, it wasn't very, you know, it hadn't been very long since Britain opposed Spain as the world emperor. And, you know, that, because that was what, the late 16th century going into the 17th century. So my point is, folks, that America and what they were doing in this convention in forging this nation and its defenses, its strategic defenses, as well as how it was preparing to create a system that would actually allow it to grow, to continue to grow unlimited. There's no limitation. In other words, there was no language ever discussed that this concept of the United States, this union, would be limited in, oh, we can only grow to this point, and then we'll blow up. I mean, and these men didn't really understand some of these things. They knew it exceeded their comprehension. As a matter of fact, when they really started talking about the West, they really didn't have understandings, which is why we're kind of rehashing this again, so that you can clearly see this is the real first point in time somebody has actually said something about admitting states into the Union. This is the first in the convention. It was brought up in passing, but this was the first time somebody actually threw out this idea, as Mr. Wilson just did, to say, hey, I don't think that these new states joining the Union deserve equal representation and deserve equal sovereignty. That, right? And this is Pennsylvania, by the way, okay? So as we kind of look at this, we move on. And so let me see here. Let me go back to this. He thought a provision ought therefore to be made to prevent the maritime states from being hereafter outvoted by them. Okay, actually, let me back this up, because there's this underlying part that I want to read again. He thought the rule of representation ought to be so fixed as to secure to the Atlantic states a prevalence in the national councils. So that's where I stopped. That's where we wanted to focus on. I underlined that for you. In other words, this is the paradigm. We need to hold this superiority over all new states. Now, think about this. Isn't that exactly what Britain did to the colonies? Well, we're going to have this dominance over you, and you will not have representation. You're a lesser society to us. It was just cause they were setting the stage for a huge problem. So he goes on and says this: the new states will know less of the public interest than these will. Than these will have an interest in many respects different. In particular, will be little scruples of involving the community in wars, the burdens of operations which would fall chiefly on the maritime states. Provisions ought to therefore be made to prevent the maritime states from being hereafter outvoted by them. He thought this might be easily done by irrevocably fixing the number of representatives which the Atlantic states would respectively have and the number with each new state will have. This would not be unjust, as the Western settlers would previously know the conditions on which they were processed their lands. It would be politic, as if it would recommend the plan to the present as well as the future interest of the United States, which must decide the fate of it. Now, Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina, because you know, here's the somebody speaking up for the eastern states, which is very specifically the northern states. Now, Rutledge of South Carolina, right? The gentleman last up had spoken some of the sentiments precisely. Property was certainly the principal object of society. If numbers should be made the rule of representation, the Atlantic states will be subjected to the western. He moved that the first proposition in the report be posted in order to take up the following, viz., quote, that the suffrages of the several states be regulated and proportioned according to the sums to be paid towards the general revenue of the inhabitants of each state, respectively, that an apportionment of suffrages according to the ratio aforesaid shall be made and regulated at the end of blank years from the first meeting of the legislature of the United States, and at the end of every blank years, but for that present and until a period above mentioned, the suffrages shall be for New Hampshire, blank, Massachusetts, blank, and so forth. So in other words, the representation. Colonel Mason now jumps in and said the case of new states was not unnoticed by the committee or in the committee, but it was thought, and he was himself decidedly of the opinion that if they made a part of the Union, they ought to be subject to no unfavorable discrimination. Obvious considerations required it. Mr. Randolph concurred. So the southern states, the hard southern states, the Carolinas, kind of agreed that they needed to make, you know, because this is where everybody's creating an advantage for themselves, because they don't want to create this uniformity. Now, one of the things, you know, because I ponder about how, you know, all the different nations in the world would be able to, you know, come into the United States. When I look at the islands of the Pacific, because there are a lot of nations out there, the Philippines, Indonesia, and so forth, and so there are those islands that are sovereign states, and then we have these small little like Marshall, Guam. I mean, they just don't really make up a unified state. In other words, you know, Indonesia is, you know, and the Philippines, those are large clusters of islands. The problem, and forgive me for going down this rat hole, but the problem in admitting each island or group of islands in, because what would be the advantage of the Philippines coming in as a single nation? It would be a huge advantage for them to break up into hundreds or maybe, you know, 20, 30, 40 different states and then join the union. And I basically would say that they would have to be, in this particular consideration, that the island states would actually be a state itself. Instead of states, there would be probably the Western Pacific, the Central Pacific, or what have you. Because even when we look at Hawaii, even though Hawaii has, you know, is a state and it has a few million people, in itself, it is contained and it holds this set level of representation. But the problem is the interest of the Senate, because this is where you could really tip the scales to where you could create an unfair advantage of those who have very specific interest of island-born over the land-born states. And so it has come to, you know, my attention, or the way I've seen this, is that these islands need to kind of bond together, that when Guam, Marshall, and the rest of a lot of those other islands would join the union, they would join under the state of, because they would be counties or territories, then they would actually become a part of the Hawaiian government, or I should say the Pacific, if they want to change their name. But anyway, these are things that we have to consider, because I believe the day is coming when we actually disassemble the United Nations. How is it that we can make sure and ensure that the checks and balances are present that actually meet the interests of all of the people? I don't want to necessarily create a disadvantage for any, but we need to ensure that we can't create an advantage for new members to a disadvantage of the union. And so these are things that, you know, I believe that need to be on the table, but this is a this is a table that has not even been formed yet. So excuse me, let me go on. So Mr. Randolph concurred with Mr. Mason, and then they said, well, on the question of Mr. Rutledge's motion, Massachusetts said no, Connecticut said no, New York said no, New Jersey said no, Pennsylvania said no, Delaware said no. I mean, the only state out of all of them, South Carolina, said yes. They all said no, based on what he was saying. So in convention the next day, Mr. Governor Morris moved to commit to much of the report as relates to, quote, one member of every 40,000 inhabitants, close quote. In other words, the representation that one member of the state or the legislative body or the House of Representatives would be a member for every 40,000. His view was that they might absolutely fix the number for each state in the first instance, leaving the legislature at liberty to provide for changes in the relative importance of the states and for the case of new states. Mr. Wilson seconded that motion, but with a view of leaving the committee under no implied shackles. Now, Mr. Morris of Pennsylvania and Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania. So I'm not surprised that they agreed. Mr. Gorham apprehended great inconvenience from fixing directly the number of representatives to be allowed to each state. He thought the number of inhabitants the true guide, though perhaps some departure might be expedient from the full proportion. The states would also vary in their relative extent by separations of parts of the largest states. A part of Virginia is now on the point of a separation. In the province of Maine, and actually they spelt it Maine, a convention is at this time deliberating on a separation from Massachusetts. I believe that's Vermont. In such events, the number of representatives ought certainly to be reduced. He hoped to see all the states made small by proper divisions instead of their becoming formidable and apprehended to the small states. He conceived that let the general government be modified as it might, there would be a constant tendency in the state governments to encroach upon it. It was of importance, therefore, that the extent of the states should be reduced as much as possible. The stronger the government shall be made for the first instance, more easily with these divisions be affected, and as it will be less of the consequence in the opinion of the states, whether they be great or small extent. So he's basically saying that the tendency needs to be breaking states up into smaller, and to keep them kind of fixed that way. But I'm not, so these are just ideas. So in other words, there's this idea board that they're throwing these ideas out, and Wilson and Pennsylvania was the first, South Carolina was next. But Mr. Gorham, and if I remember correctly, I think Mr. Gorham was from Connecticut. Is that not correct? No, Gorham was from Massachusetts, so he was New England. Mr. Gary of New England, Eldridge Gary, did not think with his colleagues but that the large states ought to be cut up. This policy has been inculcated by the middling and the smaller states. Ungenerously and contrary to the spirit of the Confederation. Ambitious men will be apt to solicit needless divisions till the states be reduced to the size of counties. If this policy should still actuate the small states, the large ones could not confederate safely with them, but would be obliged to consult their safety by confederating only with another. He favored the commitment and thought that representation ought to be in the combined ratio of numbers of inhabitants of wealth, and not either of either singularly. In other words, of the inhabitants and the wealth, not of the wealth or of the inhabitants, basically kind of combining both. Now, this is where they actually get back into the admission of states. This is the next day, right? So this is now July 6th, and we just kind of covered Morris, Wilson, and Gorham. That was starting the new day. Mr. King of Massachusetts wished the clause to be committed chiefly in order to detach it from the report with which it had no connection. He thought also that the ratio of representation proposed could not be safely fixed, since in a century and a half, our computed increase of population would carry the number of representatives to an enormous excess that the number of inhabitants was not the proper index of ability and wealth, that property was the primary object of society, and that in fixing a ratio, this ought not to be so, or to be excluded from the estimate. With regard to new states, he observed that there was something particular in the business which had not been noticed. The United States were now admitted to be proprietors of the country northwest of Ohio. Congress, by one of their ordinances, have impolitically laid it out into 10 states and have made it a functional article of a compact with those who became settlers, that as soon as the number of any one of the states shall equal that of the smallest number of the original 13, it may claim admission into the Union. Delaware does not contain, it is so computed, more than 35,000 souls, and for obvious reasons will not increase much for a considerable time. It is possible then that if this plan be persisted by Congress, 10 new votes may be added without a greater addition of inhabitants than are represented by the single vote of Pennsylvania. The plan, as it respects one of the new states, is already irrevocable. The scale of the lands having commenced, and the purchasers and settlers will immediately become entitled to all the privileges of the compact. Mr. Butler of South Carolina agreed to the commitment of the committee were to be left at liberty. He was persuaded that more of the subject was examined, the less it would appear that the number of inhabitants would be proper rule of proportion. If there were no other objection, the changeableness of the standard would be sufficient. In other words, allowing Congress to constantly make the changes. He concurred with those who thought some balance was necessary between the old and new states. He contended strenuously that property was the only just measure of representation. This was the greatest object of government, the great cause of war, the great means of carrying it on. And I've been telling you that those people who have money do anything and everything, and they send the poor to fight their wars. Just think about that. This is exactly what they're talking about. And as we look today, the Bill Gates, Soros, and all of those people are sitting comfortably, you know, flying at whatever altitude they fly, you know, where, you know, they've buried their butts up their rectums, and, or I should say their heads up their rectums, I'm sorry, that was a bad metaphor. But bottom line, these are those who are doing everything they can to seize more control and to take more and more control. How did we get from it? Because they're just talking about these principles. And as this pans out, you're going to realize that they did not cling long to these failed ideas, that they ended up all agreeing that we needed to create a union that was giving not just equality, but equal sovereignty. In other words, each state was to be sovereign. It was to become a full party in the compact, and that you could create your own advantages. Now, we have seen when you can actually, you know, increase your numbers in representation or in any body of government, you create advantages. We see this in states. This is why many population centers tax the entire state so that they can have mass transit. This is repugnant to the concept of a Republican form of government where you're actually taxing people when they're not getting that representation. That money is not coming back to benefit them. They're stealing money from those in the outskirts that are doing without, that don't need this money and the solutions. This is why the counties need to be restored within the state governments as the parties of the state. That's as simple as it can be. But when we come back, we're going to pick this back up because we're going to go through this again, because I really want to end on this whole concept of federal sovereignty in regards to state sovereignty and who really is the sovereigns. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org
and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.